Hi, I'm Jonathan Hall, host of Sustainable Futures, Kantar's regular look at the intersection between brands, consumers, and sustainability. I want to help you to get your brand ready for the future, understand where you can make an impact, and make a smarter business case for products and services that are better for people, the planet, and for business. Sustainable Futures will showcase what great sustainable marketing looks like and the issues that matter to consumers across the globe. Subscribe to Sustainable Futures from Kantar, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Welcome to Building Sustainability Podcast with me, your host, Jeffrey Hart, aka Jeffrey the Natural Builder. Every fortnight, join me as I talk to designers, builders, makers, dreamers and doers, exploring the wide world of sustainability in the built environment by talking to wonderful people who are doing excellent things. Hello and a very warm welcome to episode 66, which is the first episode of the new year 2022. This episode is the second part of my conversation with George and Summer from the Research, Design and Action Group Material Cultures. This conversation was recorded back at the beginning of November 2021, and it got parked on a shelf while some other things happened. But here it is now for you. Before we get going, there is a few things to say. First of all, Adrian Lehman, who is our guest on episode number 9. He is a Roundwood timber framer and a very nice chap. He has a whole series of courses coming up where you can go and learn how to build a crock frame, how to do Roundwood timber framing joints, and all in a very, very lovely location in Gloucester. There is a link to the show notes. I think the courses are running over the summer, and I think the first one is already sold out. So get on it. Second, Spotify. Did you hear that the Spotify CEO has invested $100 million in Helsing AI, which make AI drones for automated killing? Great, huh? So I would say that almost every musician is creating music to bring people together, and AI killing drone machines is the opposite of that. So I have just cancelled my subscription. I have shifted over to Apple Music, and I'm sure that there's terrible things with Apple. I don't think they're on the same scale as AI war machines, but please feel free to email me and tell me. And the whole transition was pretty seamless because I used an app called Songshift, which just brought across all my albums and playlists. Okay, rant section over. So this week I have had some glorious feedback from listeners who have been influenced by what they've heard on the podcast. And I just want to say it truly makes my day to hear that the podcast is helpful or just simply it's entertained you. One bit of feedback said the phrase, "Thank you for being you." And I thought that was just genuinely the nicest thing that anyone could say to me. And so I wanted to pass that on to you, all of the Building Sustainability family. Thank you for being you. And an extra special big thank you goes to Kate Brown, who created a fantastic LinkedIn post saying some just really lovely things about the podcast and linking to some of her favourite episodes and generally advertising it so well to all of her followers. And I could see from the comments that it got a whole load of new listeners interested and clicking on the link. So thank you so much, Kate. That is really, really appreciated and very, very lovely of you. That kind of brings me on nicely on to my New Year's resolution. Sorry, I'm talking a lot today. It's nearly over, don't worry. In November 2021, we hit 100,000 downloads, which was a nice big milestone. And my resolution for 2022 is to do everything possible to get us up to the 200,000 downloads by the end of 2022. And it's a fairly big step up. It took 2.5 years to get to 100,000. I'm gonna throw everything at it, and well, posts like Kate's will definitely help. If everyone did one of those, we would be halfway there already. Okay, final things. Patreon. We've got a few new Patreon supporters, which are Kate Brown. Yes, Kate Brown, you are getting all the thanks this month. Kate will be receiving a spoon that I will carve her and then post it to her sometime soon. There's a few people in the waiting list and I will get to them soon. Also, Caroline Nicolay increased her support and that helps just no end. Thank you, Caroline. What lovely folk you are. So if you did want to support the podcast, and you'll get 9 hours of bonus chat as well as access to various little bits and bobs, head over to patreon.com/buildingsustainability. You are my hero. Okay, so finally, this episode, as I said, recorded way back in November. The Insulate Britain interview, which I'm sure you've seen by now, had just happened. We talk a little bit about that. If you haven't seen that, then there's a link in the show notes. This episode is mostly Summer talking as we're talking about her project, but you do get a little bit of the wonderful George at the end. Okay, that's it. I'm back at the end. Enjoy the episode.
So we were commissioned alongside Arup, the engineering practice, to work on a research project for York and North Yorkshire LEP and the North East and Yorkshire Energy Hub. So it's a jointly funded piece of research. A LEP is a local enterprise partnership. And so they work with and represent the different portions of the region, let's say. But they gave us as a scope the whole of the North East and the whole of Yorkshire as our study. And then the research, because it sort of sits within government, and they work with local authorities, has a kind of very exciting reach, I think. You know, it's very unusual to be, for a research project like the one we undertook, to be funded through local authorities in this way, and for it then to have the potential to influence local authority policy is really exciting. A lot of the research work we've done in the past has been funded by us or through institutions we work with, or kind of through projects that we take as an opportunity to develop research. But for the research to be sought for the sake of the research itself was really great. And that they were looking essentially for a piece of work which established the opportunity for its transition to a circular and bio-based construction economy in the region, which builds on lots of work which they've already done and funded, looking at the prevalence of hemp growing and processing in places like Yorkshire and some fairly reasonably established good development work and construction work already going on in the region as a whole, and the potential, I suppose, for a bio-based construction industry to fill the gaps in lots of the post-industrialized places within the region, you know, places that have suffered quite extreme decline over the 20th century, but where there is a big construction skills gap which has the potential to be filled through lots of different things, you know, to be with like growing materials and processing them, or, you know, skills training and using them in buildings and stuff like that.
Great. And am I right in thinking that the councils up there are sort of, they're eager to be sort of leading the way?
Yeah, it's really exciting. They, as a region, well, Yorkshire wants to get to net zero before everyone else.
Brilliant.
So they've got their targets for 2030. And I think, look, you know, tens of the different local authorities in the region as a whole have set those targets. You know, there's some that are looking at 2038 and a bit later, but generally speaking, there's a lot of will, like will within the region for change. And we're really excited now to see what happens with the recommendations we made in the document, because there's a kind of mixed bag of things that should really happen at national level, but they still have agency at local level, I think, at regional level. And we're hoping that they take that forward now, and that there's an opportunity for some things to happen, which maybe demonstrates to the rest of the country how things should be done. And maybe that's what triggers us changing our policies and regulations, rather than the other way around, which of course it should be.
Yeah, you'd hope so. Yeah, what did you find in your research?
Oh, you've got to read it, Jeffrey.
You can give me the executive summary.
I'll give you the summary. Well, if anyone wants to read it, it is handily available online.
I'll put a link in the show notes, so everyone should go and read it.
What did we find? We found lots of exciting things. We, you know, part of the way we did the project was engaging with loads of stakeholders. So we interviewed, you know, tens of people, you know, and we talked to them about work they were already doing and potential for them to upscale. And I think we found that there's lots of exciting work already happening, but it needs quite a lot. It needs support to grow. So there's loads of potential already in the region because they've got established practices and they've got will. We also did an analysis. The work we did with Arup was looking at a comparative study of the embodied carbon of a new build house. So we took as our model a classic two-story, three-bedroom house designed and built by a developer unnamed, kind of common model across the UK. And we looked at what they might be building their buildings with and what the embodied carbon of that would be. So it's a limited carbon analysis because we don't have loads of information. So we just looked at the superstructure, so the structure above the ground, in terms of what those materials were and what their embodied carbon was. So we looked at structure, insulation and lining of a house above the ground, which obviously eliminates the foundations, which we know are really problematic. But what we chose to do was look at materials that are being used now and materials which they could be substituted with in the immediate future. So what would be a quick industry change, which doesn't really require reskilling people and loads of re-education. So what would be an easy win, basically, for loads of contractors and developers and clients to take on, like to move forward with. So we looked at the superstructure of a house like that, and then we designed an alternative model, exactly the same envelope and spatial arrangement, but with a bio-based wall build-up using materials which you could get within the region, or could be processed within the region, or maybe could be drawn from materials within the region but might be processed elsewhere, basically working with a timber frame and a hemp bat. And a lining board, which is one that we mentioned earlier, which is a kind of lime and hemp lining board being developed by a company called Adaptivate. And these are just examples, essentially, of other bio-based materials you could pick. They're not like necessarily suggestions, but they are what we chose to make a kind of comparative analysis of with the conventional business as usual house with. So we just basically looked at the different embodied carbon of those two buildings and found that the bio-based version of the same house sequesters so much more carbon, and essentially the impact of building all of the new build housing that the region anticipates building in the next 15 years using bio-based materials instead could save them something like 2.88 megatons. There's huge amounts of carbon, which, you know, usually are talked about in terms of like, what savings can we make with operational energy and other things. You know, what if we all stop eating meat? You know, there are things to address in society and culture, but there are also things that we could be doing with materials. And it's really just a question of specifying things differently, because the more architects that specify these things, the more they'll become mainstream. And lots of the reasons that they're not commonplace is because they're maybe not understood properly and they're not specified properly, or people don't really understand the immediate benefits. And what we tried to do in the report was to be like, well, they make this much money for the economy and they save me this much carbon and they could generate loads of jobs. So, like, what's not to like, you know?
Yeah, win, win, win. Yeah. And is that, so you said the saving a big number of tons of CO2. Is that a saving on what would be emitted, or is that a sequestration? Is that the right word?
Sequestration. It's a net saving, so it would be both.
Okay.
I think it. Right. I have to check my numbers, but I think the figures are. We looked at them both in relative in terms of embodied carbon and then biogenic carbon, but then we also looked at net, the kind of the net embodied carbon gain, and or loss rather. And so it's like, if these homes were built with conventional materials, they might emit this much carbon, and if we were built with this alternative pallet, they would sequester this much carbon. And right. Obviously there's loads of variables in that, and so we didn't look, for example, beyond what's called A3. So the way you measure embodied carbon, there are lots of stages, from a material being drawn from the landscape to being taken to a factory and processed, to being transported to another place, to be shipped and then shipped to a site and then installed on site. And our analysis was kind of abstract, so because we didn't have sites and we didn't have any of the kind of follow-on information about like who might build that and what their experience would be and how far they come from work to whatever. So we stopped our analysis at the gate, the factory gate, essentially. So it's a kind of cradle-to-gate analysis, which looks at where the materials come from and then how they're processed and when they get shipped. And then from the point that they leave the gates, it's all kind of... All of those things would obviously have a big impact on how much the carbon impact of these buildings. But it gives you an indication, I think, of like just a dramatic effect. A building with something which is sequestering carbon is just very straightforward. You know, you always make a gain because you have a considerable amount of biogenic carbon in your built fabric.
Excellent. There was a great statistic that was it for every one house you built. Hang on, I should get you to say this statistic.
For every one house built. Yes, that was a really good and kind of clear cut representation, I think. The amount of carbon. Carbon is like a kind of the amount of representative embodied carbon saved by building a house with bio-based materials is equivalent to the amount of energy that's expended, the operational energy expended by 4 British homes in a year. So,
wow.
Yeah. It feels significant in those terms when you think about, you know, just how many households are sustained. And also the kind of gain that we could make as a society for our operational energy in transitioning our material palette to these different materials.
Well, you sort of mentioned the you've looked at the emission up to sort of cradle to gate, and it seems like a lot of the emissions from gate onwards are sort of a lot down to skills and the education or the commitment, I guess, of those of sort of building the houses. Did you look at kind of what was needed, what was lacking maybe to sort of make those better and best?
Yeah, I think that was one of the most interesting sets of conversations we had. Although I should clarify a bit, skills play a part in the embodied carbon footprint of the whole building insofar as different levels of mechanization of the processes would have an impact. You know, it makes a difference if those homes were built using cranes or if they were being built off the ground using scaffolding, and those things have an impact. And so the training of builders in terms of the way they go about building has an impact in those terms. But where skills plays a really important part, I think, in the whole construction industry kind of decarbonizing is most of the skills colleges we spoke to were saying, well, we'd be really interested to teach our students these other materials that you talk about, but there's not any interest, and so we can't afford to run those classes. You know, we need 12 students or 18 students to sign up before we can afford to pay a tutor, and so no one's signing up, so we're not doing it. And those things just felt like really obvious places for some funding to slot in and make a huge change, because there is evidence that students are interested, but you know, the schools can't self-fund those courses. And they were also saying, well, actually, we could just start every cohort of students with a lecture about sustainability and construction, because maybe they don't know the impact of it and the opportunities they have to make change. And that just also feels like a really kind of a good place to start. And then it could have, you imagine a kind of generation of skilled people educated from the beginning about the impact of what they do on the environment is just a totally different way of framing the construction industry. And those felt really important. But then there's also, I think, an idea of like a kind of, there are problems about like blame. Like, whose fault is it really? Is it the guy who's like being taught how to pour foundations? It's not really, you know. There's also like, there's an educational job there about upskilling people so they have longevity for their careers and they can work on all sorts of building sites. But it's also the construction site managers, and it's also the people that run the construction companies, and it's also the developers, and all the way along the chain of education and management, actually, there should be new syllabi, like new curriculum that people can take, and they shouldn't be optional, actually. And all of those things feel like things that the CITB should be really, the Construction Industry Training Board should be taking on and being responsible for, because at a local level, again, the students want to take courses which are certified. And the certification comes from a national body. And it always comes down to this, you know, whether we're talking about insurances or mortgages or whatever. It's like, there's like local issues being blocked at a national level by something. And it, you know, translates across all of the different elements of the construction industry.
Yeah. I find it really interesting that you said that, yeah, they would offer it if there's a demand. Because, I mean, I would say it's about an email a week from someone saying, how do I get into natural building? And I don't have a good answer for them at the moment. And it, you know, it sort of seems chicken and egg, doesn't it? Like, they need to offer the courses so that, yeah. I haven't seen anyone even sort of say, we're going to run this course. Because if I had, I would have been shouting about it. And, you know, pointing all those people.
It feels like a lot with natural materials, though. There are a lot of interest in working with them is from people that are experienced builders already or looking for a career change. People are interested in them for the benefits that they bring to society and to building as a in culture. But if you take your kind of average 17, 18 year old student who's looking to get a job and be trained in the construction industry, they may not be informed about the options that are out there, but they want to be skilled and to have diverse and interesting careers and to get jobs at the end of them. And at the moment, at the end of your process of education, there aren't the jobs in those industries which represent, like, offer opportunities for people that are particularly skilled with working with hemp, for example. And so, yeah, it's like so many chickens and so many eggs. They all need to be, all those problems need to be addressed at the same time. So one of the things that would be, like, that Yorkshire or the North East could do is take that on and look at changing your curriculum at a skills college, doing a demonstrator project which offers those students apprenticeship opportunities, and then building a really big large-scale development which gets that cohort of students jobs when they graduate. If you don't do all those things at the same time, they won't be skilled and ready for the work environment, but they also won't have anywhere to go when they leave school. But if those things don't all happen simultaneously, it just won't get traction. But it working successfully once, I think, would demonstrate the impact it could have across the whole country.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk hemp, because you've mentioned it a lot, and you've said it's, you know, it's not the only material, but it is an interesting material. I think all, sort of all over, like how it's grown, how it's used, and what's, you know, why is it sort of a good material for you to use as the sort of the example material that you were sort of suggesting could be a bio-based alternative?
And one of the joys about talking about hemp is that it's such a straightforward win. You know, there are so many advantages to working with it, actually, that it feels always like a good answer to a problem. So as a plant, there are lots of reasons that it would be good to grow hemp. It's very resilient, and it tends to be you get a reasonably good crop and a successful yield from your land without needing to apply pesticides. So that's
a good win.
Great.
Yeah.
So yeah, a really good win. So Nick Vose, who farms in Yorkshire, East Yorkshire hemp, he was telling us that they get loads more birds and insects than he ever used to remember when he was looking at other crops that they were farming. And the place where they farm hemp, they just have so much more biodiversity. And there's loads of evidence for that. Because you're just not applying pesticides, so all the way up the kind of the food chain, you get loads more animals benefiting from what's effectively still a monoculture crop, but it's just a better monoculture crop in that you're not kind of, I don't know, limiting other biodiversity around it. And then the roots of the hemp plant are really deep, and so it's very good at rehabilitating soils. So as a crop option, it's a good one, kind of whether you're using it for construction or not, because there's loads of really valuable things you can draw from the plant, like the fiber and the seeds and things like that.
And its uses is like the amount of uses from one plant is a ridiculous list, isn't it? Like the bit we're using,
I couldn't enumerate them.
We're using the little tiny leftover stump essentially for building.
Yeah, it's not. We're essentially using what you would consider to be the waste byproduct of making really valuable fiber for clothing, or generating the oil, which is currently not possible in the UK because it's legislated against. But a burgeoning hemp industry is making millions and billions of pounds, not from making shit. it's not through the construction industry that the value is usually gained. But in the UK, because it's not possible to process your seeds into oil and sell them here, that is one of the major uses now. It has been historically things like horse bedding and stuff like that. The woody stalky bit of the plant, which is the shiv from the hemp, you can mix it up with lime and you make this really great, like, wonder product, which is insulating. It's got really high thermal mass. Looks very beautiful, depending on the different ways you could use it. You can, like, cast it in situ, and it has this kind of striation, like rammed earth does, and it has these beautiful stripes all the way up the wall. Or you can use it in block form, which is kind of handy and has different benefits. The thermal mass and how insulating it is, and then the fact that it's mainly plant-based, means it's got really good biogenic carbon values. It sequesters loads of carbon. So generally speaking, it's wonderful. And then the fact that you might bind it with lime makes it very resistant to mold and attack from pests, and also spread of flame. It makes it very resilient to catching fire. So it's pairing it with timber, which that's usually the way that you might build your structural frame, because it's just an insulating material. So you would either embed a structural timber frame within it, or sit your hempcrete between bits of timber. That pairing of the lime and hemp with the wood protects the wood as well. And so there's loads of kind of consequential benefits to your primary structure, which then it's also protected from mold and rot and fire. So, yeah, there's really no reason not to use it, as far as we've found so far. And there are other, like, products you can make with hemp, like hemp fiber insulation, which has been developed to be manufactured in the UK, and cladding materials using the fiber as well.
Yeah,
and the dust, the waste stream from the processing the hemp makes all this dust, which you can use in other stuff too. So lots of good uses. But at the moment, it just seems like a great answer to the problem of how to insulate the home.
Yeah. Well, and there's a sort of a little bit of an underlying stigma, I think, attached to it. Yeah. And I saw a guy stand up and do a very quick talk at it was a land workers event. And he was, you know, selling the benefits of hemp. I think he was a house builder. And at the end of the sort of his speech, he said, "And it's all built with cannabis. Yeah." And I just sort of put my head in my hands and thought, "Oh, that's not really or what we're trying to sell here." Do you see much of a sort of resistance because of that?
It always gets mentioned. Let's put it that way. But I suppose we tend to work in, it's one of the things about natural materials at the moment, the construction industry and the use of them is reasonably small scale. So often the conversations we're having with, people like yourself or like other natural builders and like construction experts is like, it's understood now that the THC content of the hemp that's cultivated for construction is so low. It's not really the same thing, but it does look the same as a plant. So obviously it's understandable, I think, that there's still confusion there. And I suppose there's always the potential for bias, but we're not growing hemp. we don't come up against that ourselves. You know, we work with people that do grow it, and they also tend to be growing it now in places where they have established, but that's what they do. I suppose where that becomes an issue, I think, is where we're looking to promote that farmers take it on as a rotational crop in place of things like wheat, or between wheat, where it's really good actually for, it really increases wheat yield values if you slot a hemp crop in between.
As in sort of grow a field of wheat, then grow a field of hemp.
Exactly. And then grow a field of wheat again. Because you need to rotate anyway, crops and kind of mixed and rotational farming techniques. I know it to be evidenced that wheat yields improve after a season of hemp. And so we're trying to promote that more hemp is grown. And one of the ways of doing that without suddenly changing the way that the landscape is used is to accommodate that alongside arable farming, which already exists. But, you know, if you want to talk to a farmer that's always grown, I don't know, sugar beet and wheat or whatever, they might not be knowledgeable about the difference between different species, like varieties of cannabis plant, and that one of them is great for construction but not so great for smoking is something that maybe still needs to be dealt with. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we're not really part of those conversations at the moment.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hey there, I'm Mick from the Mick and Pat Show.
That's right, and I'm Pat.
Looking for a podcast that's like catching up with old friends? Well, you're in luck.
We're here to bring you weekly doses of lifestyle commentary, discuss culture and politics, and top it off with the occasional beer and film reviews.
But it's not just about us. We're a community. Our listeners are our kin, and we let you all have a say in what we discuss.
So saddle up and join the conversation at the Mick and Pat Show. You can check out our website or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
In your study, where you were looking at using hemp bat for insulation, how much production would there need to be? Do you have an idea of, would it take all the fields in Yorkshire? Is it?
That is one of the things we looked at, and we looked at what the land use implications would be of all of the materials that we specified in the bio-based house. And it was really pleasing, actually, to see that the implications, again, within a kind of constrained proposed sample set. So we were looking at what is the housing need of the region of the North East and Yorkshire as a whole? How many homes do they plan to build over the next 15 years? And what are reasonable scenarios for their uptake? So some of our analysis looks at what would be the year-on-year demand for these materials if that demand increased very slowly, or if it increased very quickly. And so that kind of, there's sort of relative analysis there in terms of what the embodied carbon benefits would be and the cost implications and things like that. But for the land use mapping, we actually looked at what would it mean if we built the whole region's annual housing need for something like 30,000 homes a year with these materials. And the kind of consequences for demand on woodland were fairly limited, actually. We found that it was something like 8.6% of the current arable farming land within the whole of the northeastern Yorkshire, which would need to be farmed with hemp to supply the annual housing need of the region. So kind of demand from new build construction. That doesn't count, for example, retrofit or maybe commercial buildings or cultural buildings. And that assumes everyone's building them with hemp bats, which is not necessarily the case. But yeah, it represents a very small proportion of existing land. And what's really important is that 8.6% isn't a sole use of land. That is a 3-month blip. You know, that's one rotational crop in the rest of all the cycles of cropping that you might anyway undertake on arable farming land. So it feels, again, like that is a very easy transition to make. You know, we're not suggesting huge amounts of reforestation for that, or like taking land which is dedicated to grazing and then suddenly dedicating it to growing hemp. That's like land which is already being farmed, and you just find a different way to rehabilitate the soil rotationally using sometimes hemp as opposed to another crop. You know, and not all farms need to undertake that for it to be suddenly supplying a reasonably sized construction industry.
Excellent. And then how about timber? I mean, is it the idea that you know, the timber would be grown in Yorkshire for use in Yorkshire?
Yeah, I think, well, it was, well, our scope was the whole of the northeast and Yorkshire. And actually, if you look at their different, not quite specialisms, but maybe the existing track record within those different regions, Yorkshire is growing loads of grain crops. The northeast has within it a forest called Kielder Forest, which is fairly substantial. It's one of the biggest ones in the UK. And they have a very sizable amount of productive woodland, which supplies different timber product manufacturers in the UK. What we found within that context was that it was a really, really tiny proportion, like less than a percent of the something like Kielder Forest would need to be dedicated to producing the structural frame timber for the houses that we looked at. So again, that doesn't look at other products that you might need, but it's a really, really tiny proportion of a productive woodland. And in the context of the northeastern Yorkshire, who already have policy, well, recommendations for policies to reforest and afforest huge proportions of that land, that feels very doable. And it does necessitate a shift away from thinking about reforestation as being just for recreational use.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the interesting and conflicting things about land use in the UK is the different expectations and demands we put on them, on our land. So, you know, I suppose it's like almost the difference between like Forestry England and the Woodland Trust. You know, like, are those the woods that we plant, are they carbon sinks that we look at? And are we without nature? Like, is nature over there and are the woods there? And we look at them from the outside because they're full of animals that we don't engage with. Or are we part of it because we're animals too, and we work with a sustainable woodland management kind of to have woodland which is productive in terms of generating material but also productive in terms of facilitating biodiversity. And you know, it's like the difference between the 100-acre wood and then like rows of Sitka spruces that which are being used for construction, and like how you find somewhere in between those two things.
That's made me think a little. I think everyone that listens to this podcast is probably fairly up to date with, you know, how growing timber and working with timber is good. But did you see that thing recently? I think it was an Insulate Britain member on, was it GB News or one of the awful?
Yeah, it's hilarious. Yeah.
It's hilarious and like devastating that.
Yeah.
And the guy saying, "You're a carpenter. You're bad for the environment because you're chopping down trees and using them." He definitely shows himself to be an educated chap when he suggests you can grow concrete.
I just thought that it was so farcical that it was. I hope that that man's views are not represented across mainstream media because they're ridiculous.
Yeah.
There are still. It, like with anything, there are misconceptions about the impact that construction might have on the environment and what we're proposing will have on the environment. And I guess that's why we talk so much about land use. It's like trying to head off that before we get to those problems and trying to acknowledge them before they become issues, and like put a bit of what we already know about the problems of what's been going on in the 20th century into what we plan to do in the 21st century.
Well, that is... I mean, that's just wonderful. Is there anything else that we should talk about in terms of that project? I think all that I've really got left to talk about is your sort of work with students.
I don't know. I think for any other fun detail about Yorkshire and the North East, you should maybe read the report. It's too long.
Okay.
To try and cover all of it. And there's like lots of stuff, but I guess the most of the end of the report is about like all the regulatory frameworks which limit the way we build now.
Yeah.
But if we're going to talk about teaching, maybe George, you could talk about your students' brief this year. I think that would be really interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I teach with my teaching partner Merve at a school called DAA, which is basically an architecture school, and we basically look at we use the kind of lens of material politics to look at how architecture and the built environment are implicated in the kind of like perpetuation of colonialism and extractive practices. And so we are particularly interested in like how identities are constructed through these material processes, and specifically looking at how the global South is affected by that, and how indigenous communities in different regions of the global South are have been kind of have been affected by the project of colonialism and its kind of mega extractive development projects, which in a way are still kind of are still very much a kind of an apparatus, or these projects are still an apparatus of this project of colonialism in some form. So yeah, that's kind of what we look at, and we look at kind of we try to look at it from the lens of materials, and we try to use materials as tools for kind of implementing wider social, political, kind of economic agendas. That's it in a nutshell.
So this is for an architectural teaching. And what is there some do your students create a project at the end, which is sort of imagining a better way? Or excuse my
I mean
pretty dumb builder brain, so I maybe don't have the right words.
It's essentially what the kind of work that we do is research based, and we're really interested in like questioning the role of the architect and what that is. So we look at it from the kind of like the tools that you learn as an architect, or the tools that you have, how you can use that to bring to light a particular issue, or even to kind of propose an alternative ecology, or like an alternative kind of world or imagine how it could be better. But I think it's it's not necessarily, the proposition is not necessarily what you can build or what this kind of alternative future can be. The proposition takes the form of a research project, and actually by a rigorous kind of methodology of looking at something and really bringing to light a particular issue that is very much situated in a political discourse that is contemporary, that in itself is propositional in a way. I hope that makes sense, what I was trying to say. Mostly what we're interested in is how a project can expose or hold to account a particular practice, or like a particular system or network of systems that are essentially exploitative and at the expense of a particular group of people.
That sounds entirely like a great thing to do, and a thing that I think is quite potentially well hidden.
It is, and I think that's what makes it really exciting, is that actually we don't really think of, like, if you take a material and you kind of start to understand the entire network that exists around it, you begin to realize that actually this exists. The way that we use the material and the culture around it, and the culture around building, and the culture around consuming it, and that may not necessarily just be a material in the construction industry. It could also be, a material in another, that is used in another discipline. That actually there's a huge kind of problematic in this entire infrastructure that is not obvious. And what can you discover when you start to kind of unpack this thread? and who, you know, who needs to be held to account for that. I suppose in a way it's very immaterial.
Yes.
We're in the metaverse. yeah. So I think it's quite different in terms of output from the work that Summer and Paloma students do.
Yeah.
But I think the further you zoom out, the closer they kind of meet in a way. and I think that's maybe where there is an overlap.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really nice as well because your students have longer, I think, to address these problems. So you teach students for like a whole academic year, whereas a lot of the work that Paloma and I do tends to be for a few months, like taking a module on. So you've got the time, I think, or the students have the time to like look into all the issues around something. And I think that really complements what we do, which is kind of short and sweet and quick fire, like testing and working with project materials and building and stuff. And yeah, I'm really excited to see what the students can present us at the end of the year.
Yeah. Is there going to be some sort of, exhibition? Or
probably if things continue the way they are, I suppose, or if we continue to interact with each other in real life, there may be. yeah, probably. But I think most of the kind of the work that they do exists in some form digitally, and it will kind of sit in a kind of school projects review website kind of thing.
Great. Well, I look forward to seeing that. And then Saba is what you're doing,
what you're doing.
I guess, molding the future minds of
molding the future minds. Lots of molding. Paloma and I have been teaching together for about 3 years now, maybe a bit longer. And we teach at Central St Martin's. We've also taught at the Bartlett, and previously we both taught at the London Met, which was called the CAS once. And the work that we do with our students tends to be quite pragmatic. We work a lot where we can with our hands. We really enjoy making and also sharing that joy of making with our students, so getting them involved in building things and testing materials out. The course we teach at Central St Martin's is for the master's students, and it's a construction detailing module. So we work with them for 7 weeks to design and build a thing. One year we built a small family dwelling, or kind of a small one-bedroom house. And this year we worked with our students on a project called Carbon Copies, which was just exhibited recently. The exhibition closed at a place called House of Anetra in central London. And the work was looking really at, I suppose, iconic residential typologies that were built in over the last few centuries in London, particularly. So looking from like the terrace house to Alexander Road estate in Camden. So buildings which are known for being kind of exemplary examples of residential life, from the kind of traditional to the contemporary. And we looked at those buildings in terms of what they were made of. So our students did an embodied carbon analysis of a single residential unit. And then we asked our students to propose what they could be made of if they were made of bio-based materials, and what the implications would be for, I suppose, the way those buildings expressed themselves and what they looked and felt like. And so then our students ran the embodied carbon calculations again. And they all looked at different materials. So they visited different factories and sites of production before they designed their copies, essentially. So some of them went to the brick factory, H.G. Matthews. Some of them went to a sawmill, East Brothers sawmill. Some of them went to quarries and places where stone was extracted. And then they built one-to-one fragments of their copies. So that was really exciting. So there was a few weeks when the studio space at Central St Martin's was just full of clay dust. It took months.
Great.
Took absolutely months to get rid of. The cleaning team are still upset with that.
Welcome to my world. Yeah.
And they had a block press, so they were like making their own clay and straw blocks, and some students made their own round earth. And there was a team that had, they redesigned the terraced, a brick terraced house using fired brick outer skin, and then a cavity of clay and hemp, and then an inner of adobe unfired bricks. And there was a team of one side of the wall, they were building bricklaying, traditional bricks, on the other side, they were bricklaying kind of adobe, and they were sort of racing each other up the fragment and they were building. It was really great. And then all their copies had to meet building standards today. So it was also looking at like how those buildings had been or might have been very high in embodied carbon, but also didn't really perform very well. So they had to improve the thermal efficiency of their proposals too. It was just great. It was really fun. They made some amazing, extraordinary things, quite wild. But yeah, it was really great. We've published it now as a book. So through Central St. Martins, it's a small print-on-demand publication that people can buy.
Oh, great. Yeah. I'll chuck a link to that in the show notes. I mean, that to me, that sort of what you've just described, it seems like what architecture school should be all about. In my mind, I mean, I'm
bricklaying,
but not just bricklaying, but you know, actually getting hands on, you know, holding materials and understanding, you know, making things, seeing details in real life. Yeah, I know that architecture is a lot more than that. Maybe I don't want to give all the architects the skills because that'll do me out of a job. It seems like a really positive thing to be doing. Mm. Both of you.
Actually, I think architects are terrible makers, Jeffrey.
It depends. I mean, I'm not going to say that we are great, but I know some that are very good. But it's less common than we like to think it is, I'd say. That's probably true. But we as a species, architects, we like to think we're really good at making. But there are a few people that are really gifted at it.
Yeah.
But that's not the point. I mean, well, with teaching, I think that's not the point. It's like learning where things go wrong and how to adapt to them. That's one of the fun things. And also maybe you just learn the respect for a skill that you don't have, or that you know someone can do better. That's really important too. It's like, I mean, I made some terrible things for 5 years, like things made of wood and plaster and concrete, and I learned in the end. Like we were saying the other day, George, you learn in the end that you should pay someone well to do the thing well, because you're not going to make it as good as they are.
That is literally the conversation we had a few days ago, Jeffrey.
Perfect. This is, yeah, music to my ears.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Hall, host of Sustainable Futures, Kantar's regular look at the intersection between brands, consumers, and sustainability. I want to help you to get your brand ready for the future, understand where you can make an impact, and make a smarter business case for products and services that are better for people, the planet, and for business. Sustainable Futures will showcase what great sustainable marketing looks like and the issues that matter to consumers across the globe. Subscribe to Sustainable Futures from Kantar, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Thank you again to Summer and George for talking with me. If you've enjoyed this episode, then definitely have a listen to episode 62, where Summer and George are talking about the Waste Age exhibition in London, which I think there is still just about time to get to see. If you are quick, I'd also recommend episode 44 with Chris Magwood and episode 37 with Jan Alain Lomas. If this episode was tickling you, then those ones will definitely be your thing. That is all for me. Just wanted to say thank you so much for listening. I hope that you are really well and settling into 2022. I suspect it's going to be a bumpy one, but here's hoping. And as always, please do share this episode if you have enjoyed it. And maybe consider doing a Kate Brown and giving a nice little roundup of the podcast, maybe with some favourite episodes. Oh, that'll get us on the way to the magic 200,000. Okay, big love to you all. See you soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.